The condiment community was shocked today as DNR officials announced that North America's natural mayonnaise reserves are running dangerously low. Spokesman David Corking.
Premature spoiling is destroying millions of gallons of all-natural mayonnaise. Mayonnaise that hundreds of species of waterfowl rely on to make a wholesome egg salad.
Emergency plans are in the works to drill for mayonnaise in Alaska.
Hey everyone, welcome back to My Life as a Foodie. It's been a while, sorry for the delay. Dude Food is keeping me busy, man. Lots of work things going on, I'm trying hard to keep my head above water here. But I got a lot of things to share with you today, and I'm really excited about this. There's a really bright future for something near and dear to a lot of us, and I think that we've got very good reason to feel positive today. So to all of you who have checked out Dude Food, thank you. I'm working on the next one now. It's on chicken wings. You know, everybody says how great the chicken wings at Hooters are, but what I'm going to show you how to make will put those to shame. So if you do go back to Hooters, it won't be for the wings. You know what I'm talking about. Another part of the chicken.
Fact, there are over 300,000 Hooters Girl alumni in the world today.
I'm proud to have worked at Hooters. It taught me the value of hard work.
I am proud to have been a Hooters Girl. It helped pay for my education.
Hooters taught me the value of serving others. I was proud to wear the Hooters orange.
We are Orange with Pride.
Orange Pride. Earn it at Hooters today.
That's right. Any of you who wondered what happened to Eat Me Daily, apparently it disbanded. Half the writers went to Eater.com and the rest went to Grub Street. So, no goodbyes, nothing. It just died. I love that site too, but Eater.com is great. So is Grub Street. So if you do subscribe to Eat Me Daily, maybe change your RSS feeds to these other sites. The Atlantic is also another one, pretty hot. I like that. International Food Bloggers Conference at the end of August. Looking forward to attending that with Charles from 100 Miles, Joe from My Last Bite. I missed it last year, but I'm not missing it this year. James Osland from Savoir Magazine. He's heading it, and I'm looking forward to meeting him and talking to him about the future of food journalism, especially as it relates to food magazines. They're going to be focusing on writing, communication workshops, digital photography workshop, and Morgan Spurlock, who did the Super Size Me documentary. He's going to speak there, so I'm looking forward to hearing what he has to say and ask him some questions about how we got that project going, how we got it funded. Speaking of movies, now listen, y'all know I'm a really huge movie fan, okay? I love movies. I wish I had the equipment, the money, the time and the talent that it takes to actually make a movie. I'm crazy about Oscar season. I love following the box office. And meeting Peter was maybe one of the coolest chance happenings in my life because he's given me so much insight about what goes on in that business. It's a crazy business. It's not what it looks like. I love serious dramas, action movies, James Bond, horror movies, funny comedies, not the bad ones. But I think my favorite of all genres are food movies. And yeah, for the most part, food movies usually suck because they're chick flicks. Because it's about food and normally it's got some romantic thing involved. And so they do tend to suck. But if it's got food in it, maybe sometimes that's enough just to get me to watch it, even if it's on DVD or if it comes on HBO or something. So today, I want to focus on food movies. I want to talk about them, share some clips of a few that I own, and ask you to participate in a poll on the website. It's going to be the very first poll in the history of My Life as a Foodie. I want to know, what is your favorite food movie of all time? Now, it can be a food movie, or it could be a movie that featured a prominent scene about food that caught you and that you really, really liked. You can write in your own. But listen, if you do write in your own, right, because I'm going to have a space for other, if you write one in, can you do me a favor and put it in the comments section? Because I don't think these polls will actually capture all the others. It'll just say other, 25%. So if you do that. And again, like I said, you can have any movie that involved a food scene, and then maybe you can describe the food scene. Like, for instance, The Godfather. The very first piece of audio from the very first episode of My Life as a Foodie was the scene from The Godfather where Fat Clemenza is teaching Michael Corleone how to make his famous sauce. And it's fantastic because in the movie, and it's in context, which is a brilliant piece of screenwriting, He's basically giving you the recipe for a very basic tomato sauce with meats and everything. It was tremendous.
Hey, come over here, kid. Learn something. You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil, and you fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, some tomato paste. You fry it. You make sure it doesn't stick. You got it to a boil. You shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. And a little bit of sugar. And that's my trick.
Why don't you cut the crap? I got more important things for you to do.
And I remember hearing the commentary in that movie, and Francis Ford Coppola said, you know, it was my intention in every movie to include at least one recipe, to find a way of including it somewhere in the screenplay. Just brilliant. So I own quite a few of DVDs, and many of them are food-related. I want to play clips from those first, and then I'll give you the rest that we're going to add to the poll, a lot of which I think I've seen a few of these. I really want your participation on this because it goes along with an interactive theme that we're going to be discussing later. Something came about recently that just gave me hope for a very, very bright future in regards to food and publishing and interactivity. So I want this to be interactive. Okay, first, of course, is my favorite of all time, and I do mean of all time, Ratatouille. Ratatouille is about Remy the Rat, who is passionate about food, can actually cook. And he gets his chance to cook and be the head chef of a popular French restaurant, except nobody knows that he's in the kitchen. He's actually controlling the movements of this kid who has inherited the restaurant, but has no idea that he's inherited it. And it's the best display of French cooking, even though it's an animated cartoon from Pixar. Very entertaining, and above all else, and this is the point that Julia Child tried to make so many times, anyone can cook. Even if you guys are watching Dude Food, it's my point. It's not that difficult. If I can do it, you can do it. You just have to pay attention and follow a recipe.
Although each of the world's countries would like to dispute this fact, we French know the truth. The best food in the world is made in France. The best food in France is made in Paris. And the best food in Paris, some say, is made by chef Auguste Gusteau. Gusteau's restaurant is the toast of Paris, booked 5 months in advance, and his dazzling ascent to the top of fine French cuisine has made his competitors envious. He is the youngest chef ever to achieve a 5-star rating. Chef Gusteau's cookbook, Anyone Can Cook, climbed to the top of the bestseller list, but not everyone celebrates its success.
Amusing title, Anyone Can Cook. What's even more amusing is that Gusteau actually seems to believe it. I, on the other hand, take cooking seriously, and no, I don't think anyone can do it.
Oh, I have got to teach you about food. Close your eyes. Now, take a bite of this.
No! No! No!
Don't just
hork it down!
Too late.
Here. Chew it slowly. Mm. Only think about the taste. See?
Not really.
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness. You detect that?
Oh, I'm detecting nuttiness.
Close your eyes. Now taste this. Whole different thing, right? Sweet, crisp, slight tang on the finish.
Okay.
Now, try them together.
Hey, I think I'm getting a little something there. It might be the nuttiness.
See?
Could be the tang.
That's it. Now, imagine every great taste in the world being combined into infinite combinations. Tastes that no one has tried yet. Discoveries to be made.
I think.
You
lost me again.
Yeah.
Food Inc., we talked about that ad nauseum last year. It was up for a Best Documentary Oscar and nearly won it. Of course, it wasn't to everyone's liking. James Spencer of Basic Brewing Radio said that the movie was so full of crap that he walked out after 30 minutes. He said he'd had enough. Regardless, it did make a huge impact on a lot of people, and it got people thinking more about where their food actually comes from. Whether the movie was full of shit or not, you know, is beside the point. I think if you're a documentary filmmaker, it's enough sometimes just to get people thinking about the subject that, you know, you're making this documentary about.
The whole industrial food system really began with fast food. In the 1930s, a new form of restaurant arose, and it was called the drive-in. The McDonald brothers had a very successful drive-in, but they decided to cut costs and simplify. So they fired all their car hops, they got rid of most of the things on the menu, and they created a revolutionary idea to how to run a restaurant. And they basically brought the factory system to the back of the restaurant kitchen. They trained each worker to just do one thing again and again and again. And by having workers who only had to do one thing, they could pay them a low wage, and it was very easy to find someone to replace them. It was inexpensive food, it tasted good, and this McDonald's fast food restaurant was a huge, huge success. That mentality of uniformity, conformity, and cheapness applied widely and on a large scale has all kinds of unintended consequences. When McDonald's is the largest purchaser of ground beef in the United States, and they want their hamburgers to taste everywhere exactly the same, they change how ground beef is produced. The McDonald's Corporation is the largest purchaser of potatoes, and one of the largest purchasers of pork, chicken, tomatoes, lettuce, even apples. These big, big fast food chains want big suppliers, and now there are essentially a handful of companies controlling our food system.
King Korn was another documentary that was similar in a lot of ways to Food Inc., because it took a hard look at what's going on in the Midwest, in Iowa, Nebraska, the corn that they're growing there, and why they're growing it. It brought out some claims about cows and how sick they're getting by being fed a diet primarily of corn. And I was puzzled. At the end of this movie, as the two brothers they'd spent an entire year growing an acre of corn and finding out all these interesting facts about how you can't even eat this stuff. It's not really for, you know, consumption. They turn it into high fructose corn syrup or feed it to cows. And it's supposedly so bad for cows that they end up staying for another year. And the movie closes and they're going to do it again.
Curtis and I are going to do a taste test on our corn to see how it's coming along, to see how it's tasting.
It looks good.
It looks great.
It's not very good, Ian. Yeah. It tastes like soda.
I think that looks like a nice corn porridge.
Yeah, it's disgusting. It tastes like chalk.
I really thought it would taste better.
If you're standing in a field in Iowa, there's an immense amount of food being grown, none of it edible. The commodity corn, nobody can eat. It must be processed before we can eat it. It's a raw material. It's a feedstock for all these other processes. And the irony is that an Iowa farmer can no longer feed himself.
What are you eating for lunch here today?
Corn-fed beef! Do you actually know anything about corn-fed beef? Do you know what it does to them?
What is it?
To the cattle. It's a good thing they slaughter when they do, because it actually kills them to feed them, to make the meat like that. So they'd be dead in 6 months anyway eating that stuff, so it's just as well that they slaughter.
Really?
Yeah, it's terrible.
Where is this?
Every major confinement feedlot, everywhere.
Yes, it's cool to look out there at all those cattle and feel warm and fuzzy that I'm feeding a lot of American people. Our operation is that we buy calves and we bring them into the feedlot and feed them for 140, 150 days here, and then sell them to the packing plant as fed cattle. Basically, 14,000 to 16,000 head are finished here. We don't like being big, but right now you're looking at a family farm in Yuma County, Colorado. We're a cattle company, but we do grow a lot of corn. About 7,000 acres every year. And it is all used for animal feed.
The mass production of corn drives the mass production of animal protein in confined operations. And you got to have cheap feed to do the confinements.
When Sue's father ran the ranch, cattle spent almost all their lives eating grass, and it took several years to reach market weight. But in recent years, cattle have begun spending more and more of their lives in feedlots.
They put on weight faster if you don't let them move. So total confinement, less space for movement. They eat continually, and you get them into the market, into the food chain. But cattle were not meant to be on a corn-fed diet for that long. You know, we used to feed them 60, 90 days was one thing. Up to 120, you could make it. You start really pushing cattle on a corn-based diet after that, the ulcers and the stomachs don't take it well, and they start getting sick.
The Big Night is maybe the best movie about Italian food and running a restaurant ever made, and some might even have this on their number one list, so I wouldn't be surprised if it wins and see it finish first in our poll. If you haven't seen it, definitely see it, okay? This scene I'm about to play is where these two typical American diners visit their restaurant and they have no freaking clue about Italian food. You know, the guy orders spaghetti and he asks the guy to bury it in grated Parmesan, and she orders risotto. She doesn't even know what it is, with seafood. And then she complains there's no seafood in the dish. Then she orders a side of spaghetti with meatballs and then gets pissed off that they don't serve the meatballs with the pasta. It's all the typical stereotypes. They're all here. Enjoy.
Oh, thank God. Okay, here we go. Oh, I'm just so hungry.
Mm. You got it?
Oh, that looks good. You got leaves with yours.
There we go. Okay. Done?
For sure. Is this what I ordered?
Yes. That is a risotto. Oh. It's a special recipe that my brother and I bring from Italy. It's delicious, I promise.
It took so long, I thought you went all the way back to Italy to get it.
Yes, I know, but it's worth it, I promise. You would like a fresh pepper or cheese?
No, I don't eat cheese.
Cheese, yeah.
Oh, yeah,
cheese.
Lots of cheese.
Yeah.
Okay. Excuse me, didn't you say that this was going to be rice with seafood?
Yes. Yeah. That is, Italian arboreal rice, the best. Right. And then with shrimp and scallop and...
I just don't see anything that looks like a shrimp or a scallop. It's just not what I expected. But I get a side order of spaghetti with this, right?
Why? Well, no.
I thought all main courses come with spaghetti.
Well, some, yes, but you see, risotto is rice, so it is a starch, and it doesn't go really with pasta.
But I don't...
Honey, order a side of spaghetti, that's all. And I'll eat your meatballs.
Yeah, he'll have the meatballs.
Well, the spaghetti comes without meatballs.
There are no meatballs with the spaghetti?
No, sometimes spaghetti likes to be alone.
All right, then I guess we'll also have a side order of meatballs.
This is fine. Let's just eat.
All right, then no meatballs and we'll just have a side order of spaghetti.
Primo, please, just... Come on.
I want to know who.
Just make me the side order of spaghetti, please.
Secondo, I want to know for who is it for?
For the lady with the risotto.
What?
Why? She likes starch. I don't know. Come on.
Bitch.
I make it myself.
What are these people in America? I need to talk to her.
Oh, please. Primo, what are you going to do? Tell the customer what she can eat, huh? That is what she wants. That is what the customer asks for. Make it. Make the pasta. Make it. Make it. Make the pasta. Come on, let's go.
How can she want? They both are starch. Maybe I should make a mashed potato for on the other side.
Primo, look, don't, okay? Because they are the first customer to come in 2 hours. The fucking pipes
are... No. She's a criminal. I want to talk to her.
You know, when I pulled that clip, it reminded me of a current situation I'm dealing with at my day job. We have a creative director, all right? And the creative director basically says, this is how I want this thing to look. I don't want it like this. I want it like this. Even if I or a member of my team thinks it would look better this way, the creative director doesn't want it that way. He wants it this way. And as an employee or a business owner or a freelancer, you must think like that's your customer. Even if it's your boss, you must think like that's your customer. They're paying you to make it like they want it. So if a customer asks you for spaghetti and mashed potatoes, give them spaghetti and mashed potatoes, even if you hate it. You know, and if you don't want to do this, then get out of business. If it's driving you crazy, you either have to suck it up and move on or deal with the situation however you see fit. But don't fight them because it's the customer. You've got to satisfy the customer. They're paying you. Give them what they want. Okay, now I know some of you may have hated this movie, but I thought it was great because it told the story of Julia Child, which had gone untold before. That, and it had Meryl Streep in it, who I just love. So, and I should say, Amy Adams looks smoking hot with dark hair. From last year's Julia and Julia.
I cooked artichokes with hollandaise sauce, which is melted butter that's been whipped into a frenzy with egg yolks until it's died and gone to heaven. And let me say this. Is there anything better than butter? Think it over. Every time you taste something that's delicious beyond imagining, and you say, what is in this? The answer is always going to be butter.
It's incredible.
It's been whisked into submission, that's why. The day there's a meteorite heading toward the Earth, and we have 30 days to live, I am going to spend it eating butter. Here's my final word on the subject. You can never have too much butter.
The oven door opens and shuts so fast, you hardly notice the depth thrust of a spoon as she dips into a casserole and up to her mouth for a taste check like a perfectly timed double beat on the drums. Then, with her bare fingers, she snatches a set of cannelloni out of the pot of boiling water.
Whoa!
And she cries, these damn things
damn
are
things
as hot
are
as
a stiff cock!
She said what?
I know!
Julia Child said,
I'm in shock. Mm-hmm. I can't believe it. You're like the ones. If you and Eric can't make it work, who can?
Oh, all sorts of people can, just not me, because I am a bitch. I am Sarah. I'm a bitch.
I know you are.
Mm-hmm.
And see, that was kind of a chick flick, too, because there was this whole romance between Julie, the blogger, and her husband, and then Julia and Paul Child. And it was kind of a romantic thing, big deal. But it was cool to see that story, and there was so much cooking going on that it made it for a really good food movie. Now, here's another one that basically is nothing more than a chick flick. And I found it hard to get around the weak story, but it featured an ass ton of cooking and restaurant scenes that were really great. No Reservations. It had Catherine Zeta-Jones and Aaron Eckhart in it. And it was a disaster. Because, look, if you're going to make a romantic comedy, shouldn't the actors have some on-screen chemistry? Because the romance side of this movie sucked so bad, it made it hard to watch. It's even hard to focus on the food. Because it just, you're not buying it.
Only a full cook can really judge food. When you're hungry, everything tastes better than it really is.
I never eat in the afternoon.
My grandmother whispered this recipe into my ear on her deathbed. She brought it over from the old country, and I made it especially for you today.
Happy?
Very happy.
I thought your grandmother lived in Miami.
Well, you know. Oh, we all thought she wasn't going to make it. It was like a miracle.
So here are the rest of the food movies that have gotten rave reviews. I haven't seen these. Waitress starred Kerry Russell and Cheryl Hines from Curb Your Enthusiasm. Soul Food apparently is a great food movie. Starred Vanessa Williams and Vivica A. Fox. Listen, if those two in a movie, I'm going to stay away from it simply because who's in it? But it made quite a few top 10 lists, so I'm including it here. Chocolat, which just looks dreadful. Tampopo, which Joe says is one of her favorite movies of all time. I've never seen it, but I want to. That's on a lot of lists. Babette's Feast. Again, a little too girly for my taste, but got a lot of good press. Woman on Top. Now, I love the title. Wouldn't watch it if you tied me to a chair, though, but I'm including it. Tortilla Soup is a movie about a Mexican family who, I guess the father is a really good cook, and he's trying to get the family's a mess, and he's trying to get them together by having a series of elaborate Sunday dinners. Now, in a Mexican household or an Italian household, Sunday's the day you get together with the family to have dinner. And I've talked about this before, too. When I was a kid, we'd go to my aunt's place in Los Angeles. She lived off of Figueroa Street. And from her deck or from their patio, you could look up into the hills and you could see the cars going up to Chavez Ravine to see the Dodgers play. So on a Sunday, we'd get down there after church. And they'd go to this fresh bakery and they'd buy the rolls. And then they'd go to an Italian deli and they'd buy the cold cuts. And we'd have sandwiches and we'd sit and we'd listen to the Dodger game. I'd stare up at the hills and imagine what it was like to be at Dodger Stadium. And we'd play outside. It'd be sunny. And then about 5 o'clock, that suku had been cooking all day. That sauce was cooking. The house just smelled of it. We'd have big mounds of pasta and sauce and French bread. And they'd be drinking wine. And about, 7 o'clock, I'd pass out on the floor. Sometimes I don't even remember going home, but that was what Sunday was like. In the Greco house, it was like that all the time. But, you know, we made it up there whenever my mom didn't have to work. She worked retail. But that was Sunday. So that's what this movie's about. Except it's got, every time I look at every clip I see from this movie, it's got mariachi music in it. And listen, I'd rather swallow a .38 caliber bullet before I sat through 2 hours of that crap. But they say great movie. Okay, so there you go. That's the poll. And I'm sure I probably missed a ton. But you can write yours in. If you want to vote for your favorite, it didn't make the list, write it in. And if you do write the vote in, make sure you comment in the comment section which movie you voted for. And if it's not a food movie, like, say, 9 1/2 weeks, right? It's got that scene where he's feeding her food and stuff. Yeah. So you can write that in, but then, you know, say why you wrote that movie in. So there's that. MyLifeIsAFoodie.com. Take the poll.
You know, there's two stories going on down there. It's an absolute disaster. It's a mess. I think we, you know, we see the pictures every night on the news. But there's hope. You know, there's plenty of fishing happening right now. There's, you know, only 30% of the Gulf is closed. So there's 70% of the area that's open. The waters are pristine that are not affected by the spill. And fishermen are fishing. And the seafood is safe. You know, what's interesting is seafood typically is not tested. It goes from the fisherman to a distributor and it gets to restaurants or to supermarkets, whatever. There's no USDA inspections. But the fish coming out of the Gulf now, every bit of it's being inspected. In fact, since May 5th, I think there's been over 330 samples taken from 11,000 different fish. All of it 100% clean.
Yeah. Now you're a fan of North Atlantic seafood. I've eaten in a couple of your restaurants in New York, sure, and Atlanta, and the food is fantastic. But you've, thanks, decided to put Louisiana fish, mm-hmm, on the menu. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, you know, you look at the spill, and you have to feel sorry for what, you know, what's going on down there with the wildlife, with the people, with their livelihoods. And you ask yourself, how can you support them? Mm-hmm. This is one way to support them. I talked to people from Louisiana Fish and Game, from NOAA, from the FDA, and they're saying it's clean. And so my feeling is that you just need to let people know that it's safe. And I can't just say it's safe. I want to put it on in my restaurants and actually sell it and stand behind it.
Now, in your restaurants, are you promoting the idea that it's seafood from Louisiana?
Right now, we're working through our sources to get a good, consistent source. I have a gentleman who I happened to meet recently who was trying to sell me on it before I went down there. And I was like, well, I'm not sure I want to do that just yet. And after going down and seeing, you know, talking to the fishermen, I'll start serving it. So right now, I'm just kind of dealing with my sources.
Gotcha.
Once we do that, yes, we will promote it and let people know that we're selling it.
Because you said during your trip that what you can be here is a, quote, a mouthpiece.
Sure.
So what does the mouthpiece want people across the country to know?
That fish coming out of the Gulf is safe. Fish, you know, again, that spill, there's a huge buffer zone around that spill where you can't, mm-hmm, fish. And the questions I asked were, what are the penalties for fishing? Fishing in closed off areas, you lose your license to fish in international waters. Oh, not international waters, but sorry, federal, mm-hmm, waters. So that's 3 miles off the beach it starts. You lose your license to fish. You're done.
Yeah.
So that and the fact that the fishermen know that if tainted seafood managed to get out into the public, it's over for them.
Yeah,
so
that would be terrible. That would be terrible, very, not just, yeah, for this year, but for years to come.
That's exactly right.
So,
the funny thing is, the entire seafood industry needs to get behind this because people are walking into my restaurants now, and I've talked to all the chefs, saying they don't want to eat seafood at all, even though it's coming from Alaska or from New England or what have you. And so I think this is something the entire seafood industry needs to sort of talk about.
So what are you
about
bringing in from the Gulf Shores? Because oysters are a big problem. P&J Oysters, one of the biggest distributors in New Orleans, they're not really doing much.
Right, no, they're not. A lot of the oyster beds have been closed. Yeah. Recently, I think some of them have been opened up. In fact, the other night, I think Anderson Cooper was eating oysters right out of the Gulf on a boat. So some of the oyster beds are opening up. But shrimp, grouper, snapper, most of the tuna, or a good percentage of the tuna that's on in restaurants in New York comes from the Gulf.
Yeah.
So crawfish, that stuff's all safe. Crawfish.
Well, crawfish, you know, is fresh water.
Exactly.
Right?
It's 100 miles inland. Yeah. People still think that. Yeah. I mean, there's this perception that oil is washing up on the beaches of New Orleans. And New Orleans is 100 miles from the spill.
So we're going to see a good crawfish etouffee on your menu?
We actually had a crawfish dish on a little while ago, and it's going to go back on. Not so much an etouffee, but a crawfish dish.
All right.
You know, the other thing, I think a lot of people are maybe gun-shy about going down to New Orleans because, mm-hmm, it's one of the major attractions. I think, you know, go down there. The seafood's safe.
My friend Mark gave me this interesting article from the North County Times business section. It's about how more companies are creating tools for rooftop gardening from Trenton, Michigan, using heat from a forge that turns orange-hot metal into everything from car parts to hand tools. A Michigan manufacturer is developing an energy-efficient way to warm a year-round greenhouse on the company's roof. Trenton Forging President David Moxlow started growing fruit and vegetables atop the plant southwest of Detroit in November and has already harvested greens, peppers, broccoli, strawberries, and tomatoes that are shared with employees and visitors. The company is among a number nationwide that are developing technology and techniques for rooftop gardening as interest in local and homegrown food grows. Sky Vegetables Incorporated aims to build hydroponic farms on roofs in New York, Washington, D.C., and the Boston and San Francisco areas to make more fresh produce available in cities. Another company based near Chicago, Green Grid Roofs, sells a modular system of plastic bins that makes it easier to install rooftop beds. I think this is great. I think that, you know, you got companies that are actually growing vegetables on the top of the building. That's awesome. And then, you know, the employees get to enjoy it. I mean, people are growing their own vegetables. That's great, man. And that kind of ties in here because this is kind of interesting. CNN featured this farmer in West Virginia who grows a wide variety of these fruits and vegetables, and he sells exclusively at the farmers market in Washington, D.C., where these local chefs go, and they get their ingredients directly from him. And he credits Michelle Obama and the health initiatives from the Obama administration for his increase in sales and for people actually eating healthier. Listen.
We are full-time farmers. This is all that we do. I'm Eli Cook, owner of Spring Valley Farm and Orchard. Everything that you're ever going to buy from me is going to be fresh. It's not going to be over 24 hours old. When you eat a tree-ripened peach, I mean, you kind of got to bend over. I can tell you exactly how everything was raised from the time it was a seedling to the time it hits your plate. And you can't get that kind of service at a grocery store. The White House Market on day one was very good. You know, in economic downturn, farmers markets are thriving. We've seen no problems whatsoever. Our sales are up 18% this year. I credit Michelle Obama to this and educating everybody on how, you know, important it is to support local farms and eat local food. Never-ending job on a busy day. That's what you like.
We're just across the park from the White House. My name is Sam Cass. I'm an assistant chef at the White House and a senior policy advisor for the Healthy Food Initiative. Food is what provides us with health. So making sure that all Americans and our families, and particularly our kids, are getting food that is nutritious and healthy for them is something that the First Lady cares deeply about and therefore is something that I care about. It's no question that it's possible to eat healthy, fresh food on a low budget. It's a challenge, but it's doable. Not to mention all the negative consequences of poor health. If we continue down the path that we are, that number is going to absolutely skyrocket. So if we want to bring down costs, we got to start with being healthy.
Hi, Eli, how are you?
Hello, how are you doing?
I have been a dedicated farmers market buyer for years now. I'll take these two, and we're going to take a right at the end here.
My name is Riss Lacoste. I am the chef owner of Riss here in Washington, D.C. I feed people for a living, and it is my responsibility to feed them food that is good for them. It is very important to me that I get everything from the market as much as I can.
We're gorgeous peppers. Beautiful.
It is a bit more expensive. Well worth it. Though the product is so far superior.
He picked this at 6 o'clock this morning. Isn't that fabulous?
And I hope that it translates into what the customers are experiencing at the table.
Okay, so Rachel Ohring is a freelance food blogger, writer, and aspiring book author. Now, I've been following her blog, Gagging Towards Bethlehem, for a while, and we follow each other on Twitter. The thing is, Rachel's a picky eater, all right? She knows this, and she's doing her best to try to branch out a little bit. She's 23. She's a graduate of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and she can't stand the smell or taste of beautiful things like tomatoes, bell peppers, bananas, God only knows what else. But according to an official press release for her new book campaign, Rachel is not alone. Though not much is known about adult picky eating as a disorder, some online support groups claim more than 1,000 members. The first formal efforts to document the scope of adult picky eating began with a formal registry of picky eating, launched this month by researchers at Duke University and the University of Pittsburgh. Now go figure, they actually formed a registry of these people. And how interesting that it started at Duke. But no matter what portion of the population deals with overly selective eating, it has been proven to adversely affect the social and professional lives of those who suffer from the condition and feel compelled to hide their eating habits from the world. But Rachel isn't content to keep her picky eating in the closet. Despite the affliction, she's an accomplished food writer with bylines on BonAppetit.com, Eat Me Daily, and locally, The Independent Weekly. She's determined to explore the causes and effects of adult picky eating from sociological, psychological, and physiological standpoints, all while challenging herself to overcome her food phobias through a global gourmet travelogue. Her book in progress, Gagging Towards Bethlehem, will take Ohring around America and into Europe to speak with experts on the subject, while sampling regional delicacies she's never had the guts to stomach. She says, the reason I'm going to Europe specifically is to tackle the foods I don't like at their source, to see how they're made, and try them at their best so I can establish positive associations with the food. Much of the speculation surrounding adult picky eating seems to point toward negative mental associations, but in addition to trying to reframe her mindset, Oering also aims to explore aversions to texture and whether the phenomenon is limited to developed nations. She says, I also think writing about food through the lens of someone who doesn't necessarily like a lot of it is a new way to approach it. I agree. Inspired by the self-directed ambition she saw in the local music scene in Chapel Hill, Oering decided to forego the traditional route to publication and instead pitch her story to those who would read it. She's established an online pledge drive via Kickstarter.com to fund the research and publication of Gagging Towards Bethlehem. The fundraising campaign closes October 8th. For more information, visit Rachel's website, GaggingTowardsBethlehem.com, or email her at RachelOering@gmail.com. I'll put links on the website, MyLifeIsAFoodie.com. You guys can check this out. Help her raise money for a project if you feel inclined to do that. I think it's a really creative angle for a book idea. And honestly, I think this could be a big breakthrough for a lot of people, especially those that are close to me. I have a friend who can't eat bell peppers, okay? Just can't stand them. It's not an allergy. She just doesn't like them. My wife, lots of textures she can't handle. Won't eat things like clams, oysters, snails, mushrooms. My friend Mark, same thing. Won't eat these things. Not because he's not adventurous. Same with Katrina. She'll eat stuff. She's adventurous. It's just because just can't handle that squeaking that goes on inside of the mouth while you're chewing on one of these things. Now, is it a mental block? Is it something you can get past? It'd be interesting to see how many of these things that Rachel can't stand putting into her mouth now that she can get past and figure out how she got past them and then spread that knowledge. Now, why is this important? Well, if you truly love food and you love new experiences, but there's something inside your brain that's preventing you from enjoying some of the greatest gifts of the world of food, then it's worth unlocking that, right? GaggingTowardsBethlehem.com. Help Rachel help herself and help others. I do think it's our culture, though. I think the reason why a lot of people don't eat things as adults is because they didn't grow up eating them as kids. Now listen, if you didn't grow up eating kimchi, tofu, raw fish, mussels, you're not going to enjoy them as an adult, more than likely, unless you just become adventurous. And if you don't feel like eating it as an adult, Who's gonna force you? There's no one there to force you to eat this stuff. But again, it's cultural. Look at the school lunch issue we've been barking about so much lately.
Well, I've been spending the last few hours having a look online to see exactly what kind of meals schools serve around the world. Well, let's start off things in Japan. You can see here a very traditional bento box. You think this isn't a restaurant, but this is, in fact, what about 99% of the school students there in Japan eat, a very traditional meal. Now, most parents there pay about 200 to 300 yen to ensure that their kids have a pretty well-balanced meal during lunch hour. In Korea, it's much the same, a very traditional balanced meal here. You have a soup of tofu, some spinach, a banana, some rice, as well as the traditional Korean delicacy of kimchi. So very traditional stuff there as well. In India, now, every school student that attends a government-funded school, they're entitled to one free lunch during the school hours. And as you can see, most students there will indulge on a little rice, curry, and a dish of vegetables. In Malawi, it's much the same, a traditional, very traditional African meal of beans, a bit of vegetables, as well as rice. Now, in France, a really interesting look at the clash of cultures here. You can see that influence of the American French fry is starting to creep in, but if you look on the outside of this traditional plate, it's very classic French cooking. You know, you've got an artichoke, a bowl of mussels, grapefruit, as well as some yogurt. So, some very interesting stuff there. But of course, the king of junk food and unhealthy school lunches is the United States of America. Take a look at this. You know, your traditional American lunch, at least in schools for that matter, is French fries, chicken, hamburgers, even soft drinks. So a really interesting look at some of the contrasting school lunches that are served around the world from east to west.
All right, so Gourmet Magazine is making a comeback, and perhaps the smartest move they possibly could ever make. They're making an iPad application. It's going to make the magazine interactive instead of a print magazine. You remember what happened last year? Bon Appetit and Gourmet Magazine were owned by the same publishing company, and they had to close one down, and they decided to close down Gourmet. Now, there was a lot of talk about why it closed down. A lot of people pointed fingers at Ruth Reichel. They said she did not manage it correctly. Now, who's pointing blame? I mean, maybe it just wasn't selling. Maybe they couldn't sell advertising. Bon Appetit is a great magazine, but I think it's less of a tabletop magazine than, say, Savoir or Meat Paper or Gastronomica. Okay, where I think magazines like these, they've got great photography and they can really benefit from video and external links, they can really shine as an application for the iPad. If you've not seen an iPad, go check it out. Go to an Apple store and look at this thing. I don't know what it is about it, but photography looks better. Even non-high definition video looks fantastic. Things just look great on an iPad. There's something about the resolution on that thing makes it look, even relatively marginal photography looks great on an iPad. And having something interactive, especially a food magazine, might just be cutting edge enough to save the world of publishing. Now, have you seen that two-page spread in magazines for magazine publishers? It usually has a big picture on one page, and then there's text on another. I'm going to read it to you. Well, there's a lot of different ads. I mean, it's all done by the same company. I think it's just kind of a magazine conglomerate. This particular one is in Bon Appetit magazine. It's got a picture of Michael Phelps on the left. And on the right, it's got this text. It says, "We surf the internet. We swim in magazines. The internet is exhilarating. Magazines are enveloping. The internet grabs you. Magazines embrace you. The internet is impulsive. Magazines are immersive. And both media are growing." Think of it this way. During the 12-year life of Google, magazine readership actually increased 11%. Whoa, that's some growth, huh? In 12 years? Not bad. It proves once again that a new medium doesn't necessarily displace an existing one. Just as movies didn't kill radio, just as TV didn't kill movies. An established medium can continue to flourish so as long as it continues to offer a unique experience. And as reader loyalty and growth demonstrate, magazines do. Which is why people aren't giving up swimming, just because they also enjoy surfing. And at the bottom says magazines, and magazines is made up of all the different pieces of typography from like Maxim, Vanity Fair, Rolling Stone, Esquire, GQ, all that stuff. Anyway, I think the point is that, you know, the internet came along and it's not going to steal the thunder from magazines. I don't know how long magazines are going to be around. What I do think is that iPad applications and the iPad itself are going to make publishing fun again. They're going to make reading fun again because it's interactive. And, you know, basically what's stupid about this is that you read this in a magazine, you're preaching to the choir. I'm already reading the magazine. Why are you trying to convince me? And I'm already subscribing. It's cute, but it's ineffective. If it says anything, it's that they don't want me going to an interactive magazine, which is where I think publishing is headed. Now, here's an example of how these magazines can really soar. This is from SeriousEats.com. It's an oyster quiz. And on their website, you go to MyLifeAsAFoodie.com. I'm going to provide a link to the website. I want you guys to take this quiz and then report back and tell me how you did. I got 7 out of 10 correct. And I think it's a lot of fun and very educational. I'm not going to read all of the questions, but some of them. Here's like this. True or false? If an open oyster stays open after you tap it with a finger, that means the oyster is alive. True or false? Oysters are high in cholesterol. True or false? Oysters are capable of changing genders. Okay, that one's true. And to quote Anthony Bourdain on A Cook's Tour,
here's a lascivious fact that would have made us giddy as kids. Oysters change sex every year.
So, Chris, how do they make oyster babies?
The females spew out millions of eggs into the water, and the males just spew out sperm, and it all just mixes around like something super.
Sort of like a pool at Club Med.
Absolutely a cesspool of sexual activity going on out here.
So, if you were to tell an oyster to go yourself, that would not be an insult.
What is the month rule for eating oysters? Everybody should know this. That's important. What's an oyster crab? Blue points are typically grown in which region of North America? Fun quiz. So take it and let me know how you did. All right, listen, I think that's enough. Nice show, I think. Right? Played a ton of audio. I'm sure I'll be getting legal notices up the ass soon, but hey, it's worth it. Thanks again to those of you who are checking out Dude Food. Please help me spread the word with that. Chicken wing episode coming very soon. Keep your eyes out for that. Thanks to The Onion and CNN.com for the audio clips. Music in this episode from Day of Fire. If you like the song, you can purchase it on the band's website, myspace.com/Day of Fire. Go to MyLifeAsAFoodie.com. I'll give you direct links. You can purchase the music. Until next time, my name is Phil. This has been My Life as a Foodie.
Feeling down, I'm burning the day. Done with everything that I've thrown
Leave the gun. Take the cannoli.